This is an ABC podcast.
Hi, it's Hamish here. Before we get started with this episode, we have so loved getting your comments and reviews on the listening apps and via email now as well. The email address is tmtyl@abc.net.au. That's tmtyl@abc.net.au. Send us an email, make a suggestion on a leader you think we should cover. But right now, let's get stuck into Sanna Marin. Well, you probably know our next leader as Finland's party PM. That's what the headlines said. She was filmed dancing and drinking with her friends, and the videos went viral. It's not exactly the kind of scandal you see engulfing some of the men we've profiled in this series. Leaders like Putin, Xi Jinping, and Benjamin Netanyahu. And so in this episode, we're looking at a young woman who's breaking records and stereotypes. She was raised in a rainbow family, brought up by two mothers. She's pushing to have one of the most ambitious climate targets in the world. And she's making hard-headed geopolitical decisions that many of her predecessors actually shied away from, like joining NATO. She's the world's youngest prime minister. She's Finland's Sanna Marin.
It's a very challenging job. It's something that you cannot prepare. But also it's a job that fits for a human being. I think it's very important that we have people from many genders, many generations, many backgrounds in powerful positions making the decisions together. I think this is the only way to make sure that the decisions are good ones.
Sanna Marin became Finland's third female prime minister at just 34 years of age. Her coalition of women-led parties suggests that perhaps another kind of politics is possible. But Sanna Marin's gender is perhaps far less notable than her character and her accomplishments, packing an extraordinary career into just a few years. Sharing a direct border with Russia, she finds herself navigating choppy diplomatic and economic waters for Finland, and making the case to other world leaders on taking a tougher line against autocrats. So, who exactly is this millennial leader? How did she make it to the top? I'm Hamish McDonald, and this is Take Me to Your Leader. Hi, Laura. It's Hamish in the studio in Australia. How are you?
Hello, Hamish.
And is Sala there as well?
Yeah, I am. Good evening from Helsinki, in the capital of Finland. My name is Sala Vuorikoski. I'm a journalist. I work for Helsingin Sanomat newspaper, which is the biggest newspaper in Finland.
Thank you. I'm Laura Liswood. I am sitting right now in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I am currently the Secretary General of the Council of Women World Leaders, which is a council composed of women who are presidents and prime ministers of their country. Sanna Marin is a member of the council. There are now 89 members of it. Any woman who is freely elected head of state or head of government is invited to join the council, although we have a tendency to wait about 3 months to make sure they stick. So that's a little bit of what I do.
So does that mean Liz Truss is not a
member? She is not a member. Very pointedly, Hamish, you picked that up very quickly.
Hi, I'm Hervé Lemayeux. I'm the Director of Research at the Lowy Institute, which is a foreign policy think tank based in Sydney.
And you also do the power index for Lowy, so you look fairly closely at the way power works and how leaders wield their power.
That's right. We're very cold-hearted in our appraisal of different countries' powers.
Sala, I want to start with you as a political journalist. You've had plenty of interactions with Sanna Marin. What's she like up close?
She's not that much of a normal politician anymore. She's become a kind of leader figure and she's straightforward. She's not that much into daily politics anymore. She's more of a manager and trying to keep her government together.
I had the opportunity to interview her late last year. She was pretty direct, but also seemed fairly no-nonsense. Is that a fair observation, Sala?
Yeah, she's very confident and she gets a lot of critic in Finland for various things as politicians do. But we get the feeling of her not interested in the critique. She's very, did you use the word, no-nonsense kind of a person. So she's really confident and she's getting, I think, more and more confident.
Does she stand out as a leader? If so, why?
Look, from day dot, I think Sanna Marin has always had something special to her. She's always been a celebrity. She was the youngest prime minister in the world and commanded the headlines, and you know, the tabloid press would chase her to her holiday in Italy and all the rest. So she's always had that star factor, but there's another layer to her now entirely ever since Russia made that calamitous decision to invade Ukraine, and then she became a war leader. And I think that's where she started becoming a bit more interesting to us, at least. And this is a remarkable person who leads a remarkable country. It's hard to separate her story from the world's fascination for Finland, in particular its history with Russia, its contested independence, its border that is 1,300 kilometers with Russia, its position from moving from, you know, neutrality to deciding to join NATO. All these decisions have been made under Sanna Marin, and there's a certain strength and clarity to her. There's also an urgency. And so I think she's really caught the world's imagination. She's stepped up to the plate in ways that leaders do. You've got to be a special person, but you've also have to be dealing with very exceptional circumstances.
So I think Sanna Marin's upbringing and her own personal story is really interesting and probably speaks to where she's ended up. She was born in Helsinki in 1985. Her father reportedly was an alcoholic, and this led to the breakdown of her parents' marriage. Sanna was quite young and says she had no relationship with her dad. She was then raised in the industrial town of Tampere by her mother and her mother's female partner, and she describes it as her rainbow family. She's also said, though, that that relationship wasn't all that acceptable in the 90s there, and that she often felt isolated. As a teenager, she worked at a bakery for pocket money and was the first person in her family to graduate high school and go to university. Sala, what would it have been like growing up there in the 90s? I mean, was it a really progressive space that led her into the kind of politics that she has ended up in, or is she reacting to that?
Well, she was growing up in Tampere, which is one of the biggest cities in Finland, and this is her family was quite poor at the time. The city is also social democrat or left wing. And well, it was a time when we had the female president. And I think she has also said that that affected her growing up. So she started to feel that she wants to do politics.
And was she showing signs at an early age of interest in politics, though?
Yeah, I think she spent like 3 years when she finished high school and like was looking for her future path and before she started in the university. So she was working as a cashier in a store, which is something that when some people want to mock her, they always say that, you know, this girl who has been working as a cashier, that what does she know? So then she went to the university and started studying this science that deal with public authorities.
Like public policy or?
Yeah. And, little by little, she started getting interested in politics. And so that has been her profession, really. She doesn't have much other background if you don't consider this cashier work and this kind of work.
It's a really interesting observation, Laura, because one of the other leaders that we've looked at in this series is Rishi Sunak. And one of the things that has been pointed to is his desire to always talk about the fact that he'd worked in an Indian restaurant for a brief period of time as a way of kind of
making him more relatable.
Exactly, given that he comes from and is of such wealth. Does this tell us something about leadership in general, or is this actually gender, that if you're a woman and you've done a job like that, it's a negative, whereas if you're a male and you've had a successful career in banking, if you briefly worked in an Indian takeaway, that's a good thing?
Well, I think it's in a funny sort of way, it's a good thing for either gender, because what it does is you always are then in the non-dominant position. You are in those positions marginalized. And therefore, you have much more of an understanding, in a sense, of what it's like to be not privileged, to be historically underrepresented, to understand that dynamics. So, yes, there's probably a little bit of the gender of, okay, you know, you're a waitress, and therefore, how can a waitress do anything? And, oh, you know, Prime Minister Sunak, aren't you great? You're a person of the people. But I think for both groups, for both genders, it does provide you a very different perspective on the world. And I think that for any good leader should have the knowledge and understanding of, you know, everyone that they're leading.
I think it also says something about Finland, doesn't it? I mean, for the UK, that's all about class-based politics, right? I mean, it doesn't actually matter what your race is, it's your accent. But I think it's fascinating that in a country like Finland, really egalitarian, small social democracy, where income inequality is almost non-existent relative to other West advanced economies, that you can go from being a relatively impoverished cashier in a store to going to university with subsidized education and then make your way into politics within the span of, 5-10 years, become Minister for Transport and Communications and eventually become Prime Minister. I mean, isn't that amazing? In many parts of the world, including in liberal democracies that we're used to, that would just be unheard of. I mean, even in Australia, I think politics is a very closed community. And unless you really know everyone and have started at a very, very young age and know exactly that you need to join the right student union or whatever it is, young liberals, young labor, you're out of it.
I just want to make a footnote to that, though. Yeah. But you know, you've got a prime example of what happened to a female prime minister in Australia with Julia Gillard, right? Here she was, from, I think, ticked all the right boxes, and yet what happened to her? You know, she got faced with a huge amount of misogyny within the Australian political system. So it kind of didn't matter in that sense that she had grown up with all the right bona fides, as you mentioned.
Well, tēnā koutou katoa. Today, it has been my pleasure to host Prime Minister Marin of Finland.
Thank you so much, Jacinda. I'm very pleased to visit today. Thank you for the very friendly reception to Auckland and New Zealand.
Yeah, a lot of people will be wondering, are you two meeting just because, you know, you're similar in age and, you know, got a lot of, you know, common stuff there, you know, when you got into politics and stuff, or can Kiwis actually expect to see more deals between our two countries down the line?
Because my first question is, I wonder whether or not anyone ever asked Barack Obama and John Key if they met because they were of similar age.
Yeah, we are meeting because we are prime ministers.
Laura, does it make it more difficult being a leader if you are young and you are female? Are there particular challenges that come with that in terms of how you're perceived either by the public, the global community, or even other leaders?
Well, I think it does. I'm not so sure about the young. That's sort of an interesting addition to the slicing of the gender analysis. Now, we've seen relatively young male leaders. Yes, she's the youngest prime minister, but probably not by a lot. I was not surprised in the slightest when she got the over scrutiny, because virtually every woman leader that I have dealt with, interacted with, spent time with, interviewed, with the exception of Margaret Thatcher, I'll put that one out there, noted that they were over scrutinized by the press, over scrutinized in their behaviors by average citizens, that there was less tolerance for mistakes if you were a woman. There was less of what's known as the leniency bias. Looking at their dress, their speech style, it doesn't surprise me. Now, the interesting and fascinating thing about Finland, and you can also see this in some of the other Nordic countries, is that there have been a good number of women. There's been Sanna Marin herself, but then there's Mari Kiviniemi. Sala, you're going to have to help me pronounce Anneli's last name, Yatinamaki.
Yeah, I'm sorry for that.
A female. Yeah, I mean, it really is a language in search of vowels.
yeah, I understand.
And then President Hallinen, of course. So you've had four women at the top, which starts to, a little bit neutralize the gender elements of it, but not completely. You sometimes will see, because women are normally historically out of power, that they often rise to the occasion during crisis times, you know, when there is a need to have a kind of a change up of style. That's known as the crumbling cliff theory of women's leadership, was, just when the cliff is about to crumble, they say, well, let's try a woman now. And any individual leader is either going to rise to the leadership challenges or not rise to the leadership challenges. I don't think leaders are made so much as that they're born, that they rise to the specific instances of the circumstances, and she clearly has, with reference to Russia and the aggression, etc.
Yeah, and the war in Ukraine has been like a big thing for Sanna Marin and her government, but we have to remember that there was also another big crisis, the COVID crisis, that started almost after she got to be prime minister. So she has been this kind of a crisis prime minister for all these years, and that has probably shaped her leadership a lot. But I want to comment on the fact that you already mentioned that we have had female politicians in high positions. We have had a lot of female ministers, and we have MPs, a lot of women MPs. And as you said, we have had Tarja Halonen as president for 12 years. So I think for us in Finland, the gender of Marin is not that big of a deal. Her youth, yeah, maybe more. But I think that internationally, that has been bigger. You know, nowadays we have the government, all the parties in the government, they are led by women.
What I find fascinating is this juncture between a leader's global image and their image at home. And what makes Sanna Marin special in Finland may not be what makes her special on the world stage. And so I think from the perspective of the world, she really shot to fame in a sort of more serious sense following the war in Ukraine. Although I totally understand, and in fact, Finland deserves huge credit for its handling of COVID, the fact that it was stockpiling in many instances when, for example, in Australia, we were not. But what I find also fascinating is the fact that, as you say, both of you say, women leaders in Finland is a far more normalized state of affairs. And in fact, it's not just her, it's her coalition parties. All of the leaders are women, most of whom are under the age of 40. And there, if anything, there was, I think, a controversy that there were too few men in cabinet, that was a deviation from gender parity in the other direction. I think there's a norm that at least 40% of cabinet positions, of ministerial positions, have to be allocated to either gender. But I find it absolutely fascinating. This is the state of where we're at in Finland, which is a beautiful situation to be in. And again, highlights the discrepancy between how we would see the relevance of Sanna Marin outside, because we haven't reached that level of parity yet, and how she's viewed in Finland.
Well, of course, Sanna Marin got worldwide attention when she was caught on video partying. The leaked video showed her dancing and drinking with her friends at a party, at which there were unsubstantiated reports that she may have been taking drugs. She then volunteered herself for a drugs test, which found there were no narcotics present. And here she is giving a teary yet forceful speech in her own defence.
I am human. During these dark times, I too need some joy, light and fun. And that involves all sorts of photos and videos, which I would not like to see, and I know you would not like to see. It's private, it's joyful, and it's life. But I have not missed a single day of work, a single work assignment, and I never will.
Sala, how big of a story was that domestically? And is that why you think actually her age has been perhaps more of a factor?
Yeah, it was a big story in Finland for maybe a week or two. And of course, internationally. I think here is the same thing that applies to many of these kind of scandals, that when you look it from abroad, it seems like, okay, the prime minister was dancing, and now the stupid Finns are like upset about that. But the discussion was maybe a little bit more detailed here, because Sanna Marin was talking that she wants to shake the institution. So during the summertime, she had been seen in some places. She was quite heavily drunk and she was partying a lot. And so people were talking about, you know, the security of the prime minister and security of the state and what kind of how she considered these situations, that was it wise for her. And at some point, there were some photos from the official residence of the prime minister where there were these friends that she was partying with. They were like half naked taking photos. And so there were some people were saying that, well, Sanna Marin wants to shake the institution, which she did, really. But did we ask for that? And many people were supporting Sanna Marin and thinking that this is just too much fuss of nothing. And some people were thinking differently. So there were more like detailed things in that discussion in Finland, not just can Prime Minister dance.
It obviously garnered a lot of attention globally, but what did it do to her popularity at home, Sala?
Probably nothing, I think. She was popular and she still is.
Is it a real factor in power if you have a kind of celebrity status? Like, obviously, Jacinda Ardern, as New Zealand Prime Minister, did something for the way New Zealand was perceived in the world, even if she didn't achieve everything she promised to do domestically. Does it play a real part?
Absolutely. Absolutely plays a part in shaping a country's image abroad. I think someone like Sanna Marin really changes the view of a country. Now, it's interesting because abroad as well, there was a lot of controversy around... Well, in fact, there wasn't really that much controversy around the leaked videos. I didn't see any criticism. I saw lots
there's
of
a lot
outpouring
of support, right?
Of support, that's right. I didn't actually see any criticism. And it's also worth recalling that, you know, the Finns have a very high threshold of integrity. The smallest mistakes, I think there was a controversy in 2014 because the male prime minister at the time decided to wear shorts at a press conference. That's where, you know, that's what we're talking about here. So very different to, say, Boris Johnson or, you know, in the UK, or what the standards of morality we're used to from presidents like Trump in the US. So I think you do have to sort of analyze this in local context and allow for that nuance in the discussion.
You saw her in person at the Lowy Institute last year. I mean, is there something that sets these type of leaders apart? Is there a sparkle? Is there an X factor?
Yes, probably. I have to say I was really grumpy on the day. I had a few deadlines and I recall calling the lift. I was pressing the button furiously and I was like, why is this lift not getting there? And then the lift opens and she's in it, but I didn't immediately recognize her. So I was a bit embarrassed. But anyway, I scooted in. There was like four other people in the lift, but I was really, you know, angry and intent on getting to my desk. But she cracked a smile and she has this really kind of intense eyes, and you do sort of immediately get drawn into the presence of someone special.
Sanna's role as a young female leader has also made her a target of hate speech. A recent report by NATO's Strategic Communications Centre found that female Finnish politicians were particularly subjected to gendered hate on social media platforms like Twitter, much of it coming from right-wing accounts. So this is what Sanna Marin had to say about that.
When you're young and female, the speech, the hate speech that we are facing are often sexualized. It's actually focuses on that you are a woman. So, of course, it matters. And we can see that about the speech that we are facing on the social media, on the internet. But as I said, I try to ignore this, not to affect me and my decisions. But I worry about so many others, and this is why we have to make sure that we are not tolerating this kind of behavior.
Laura, how common is it for women in power to receive that kind of vitriol, even threats?
Oh, I mean, I think the research is quite clear that women, not just women leaders, but just, you know, any woman on the internet who takes a position on something, congresswomen, et cetera, in the United States, are getting disproportionate amount of this kind of hate speech. And, you know, her comment around being young, you know, you get somewhat sexualized on it. But, you know, we saw a huge amount of hate speech against Hillary Clinton. So it wasn't youth that was that. It was basically this reaction, backlash to women having power, to women having agency, to women being in these positions, because for a lot of men in societies around the world, there is this sense that their rightful, entitled positions in the world are being eroded and taken away from them by these women who, you know, don't know their place in society. And so we're going to put them down.
And Laura, is there something, do you think, different that's going on in that part of the world at the moment? Estonia, Denmark, Sweden all have women leaders right now.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there's an interesting element to that as to why is that. I mean, you have these affirmative mechanisms, which brings more women into the ministerial positions. And the ministerial positions in Europe are much more the pipeline into prime minister positions than in the United States, for example, or some other countries. So you're starting to get a real critical mass of women who are just prepared. And a lot of times in the Nordic countries, you will see the fact that their fishing cultures back in the 1100s or 1000 or whatever. And men went off to fish 10, 11 months of the year. And the women, way back then, were actually responsible for everything, the economy, the politics, the households, et cetera. So we can't separate out some of these other factors that lend themselves over time to why, you know, women may be more accepted as leaders in a country. You know, the Greeks say leadership is a combination of chance and genius. You know, so she had an element of chance to her, but she also had the genius of working way up through all of these positions.
Reading Sanamara's political trajectory, it's incredible. It's almost like she was riding this shotgun to the top. She became the head of the city council of her industrial hometown at the age of 27. She was a rising star in the centre-left Social Democrat Party. She co-wrote the party's environmental platform. By 2015, she was then a member of parliament, serving as Minister for Transport and Communication. Then in December 19, her predecessor was forced to resign in the wake of a postal worker strike, and she was chosen in a narrow vote to replace him. And suddenly her image was ricocheting around the world. Her young female-led coalition was hailed as a countercurrent to the right-wing nativism sweeping across Europe. Sala, was it a surprise when she ended up in the top job?
Yes, I think she was in the right place in the right time, because the crisis with the previous prime minister just started quite suddenly. And she got, I think it was something like 3 votes more. So it was really narrow. And I remember watching the vote. I think I said to my husband that this will be a big thing abroad. And I think it took a lot of time in Finland before we realized that Sanna Marin was chosen. It will be like international news and big news. And well, you've seen what has happened since.
Sanna Marin represents a kind of green and tech-friendly social liberalism backed up by more taxes and spending. Is she fairly orthodox in her actual politics?
Well, I think what makes her unorthodox, viewed from the rest of the world's perspective, is that you have a progressive politician representing a strong social democracy and at the same time burnishing really strong national security credentials. And normally we sort of think of national security as belonging to the right inherently, and that progressive politics is much more about human welfare and prosperity and less about hawkish geopolitics. It's the fact that she marries both, which makes her quite, I think, novel and refreshing and thought-provoking.
So what's she done that puts her in that camp in your mind in terms of the geopolitics?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, she's made her mark by standing up to the aggressor next door. So that was a big thing. And by taking a landmark decision to essentially deviate from decades of neutrality, as in they weren't part of NATO, neither were they really part of the Russian sphere of influence, to decide, no, Finland, along with its neighbor Sweden, firmly belongs on the NATO side of the ledger.
I do want to say that there is a bit of a gender lens to this national security credentialing, an underlying archetype that certainly liberal parties or progressive parties, et cetera, are the mommy parties and the conservatives are the daddy parties. But we do know from the research that there is a potential archetype assumption that women won't be as strong in their standing up to other aggressive leaders or terrorists or whatever. So not only does she believe all of this kind of stuff, but I can imagine her advisor saying, okay, because you're a woman, you have to come out even more strongly with more definition around your national security beliefs and your ability and desire to withstand this, because there's already an assumption that you won't be as strong and as forceful as a male leader.
And I'm sure in Putin's worldview, for sure, you know, that he probably totally underrated and underestimated not only Finland, but Sanna Marin. So he must be rather surprised with his gendered lens at the strength of some of these women leaders.
But I'm sure, because I'm sure he's, you know, he's grown up in a very gendered society, Russia. You know, he probably underestimates many people, including many women. But my point being is that she, as a leader, has had to sort of flex that style of leadership more evidently than a male leader is. Because a male leader, there's just an assumption that, okay, he can withstand that until he proves he can't. For a woman leader, it's more like the assumption is she can't until she proves she can. And of course, the best leaders are those who have their ability to flex their leadership style across the widest spectrum of behaviors. And so, you know, bringing women in will potentially add some other elements to leadership that perhaps male leaders have historically not demonstrated.
Sanna Marin's credentials on climate change are strong. She's committed her country to net zero emissions by 2035. And what's really interesting about this is that it also plays into her strategy of energy security, which in turn plays into the geopolitics with Russia.
Because as Sanna Marin herself has said, the more you are dependent on Russian energy, the more you are essentially financing the Russian side of the war in Ukraine. So it's all coming together in some sense. And Finland, I mean, the war has really accelerated this this transition towards hydrogen, towards other forms of renewables and nuclear, away from dependency on Russia. And she had a very similar message to us at the Lowy Institute and Australia more broadly when she came here as the first Finnish Prime Minister. To Australia, basically saying, look, it's very obvious, it's very clear, we need to lessen our dependence on authoritarian regimes.
Make no mistake, if Russia wins its terrible gamble, it will not be only one to feel empowered. Others will also be tempted by the same dark agenda. We need to draw the right lessons from the recent global challenges, wars and crises. In increasingly critical areas of our societies, from medical equipment to new technologies and energy, we have become far too dependent on cooperation with regimes that do not share our common values.
Ove, this was interpreted not just as a message about Russia in the Finnish context, but also for countries like Australia in relation to China. What's the sort of, intellectual argument that she's making to the world in terms of learning a lesson?
Yeah, I mean, she's not the first one to link the two theatres, what's happening in Europe with what is potentially happening here in Asia. But the point she's making is that, look, we have these enormous authoritarian challenges in our respective regions. We've kind of duped ourselves into thinking that globalization and economic interdependence would somehow paper over the cracks and that there was no real risk emanating from dealing with these authoritarian regimes. And Europe has woken up, and so should leading democracies in the Indo-Pacific relative to China. Now, she's not saying, look, that means you have to stop doing all trade with China, but I think the Europeans are a little bit more nuanced here than the Americans. So the Europeans are calling for de-risking rather than decoupling, to use a bit of technical IR international relations speak. But basically they're saying, look, you can continue to do some trade, but for the core technologies, for the critical things that keep our societies afloat, we need to be more dependent on each other. And by each other, she means democracies.
Sala, where you are, how much of a threat does Russia feel like during the Ukraine conflict?
Well, the spring 22, when Russia invaded Ukraine, was a huge shock for Finland and for Finnish politicians. We have really nurtured the idea that let's do business with Russia. And of course, we have the border. It's obvious that we have to interact with them. And let's keep them close and let's be friendly and let's not look at these facts that have happened, like, you know, invading Crimea and the Malaysian airline shooting down that and all these things that have happened during the years. We have been like closing eyes. And when the war in Ukraine started, it was very amazing what happened in couple of weeks or a couple of months, how the whole political discussion and in the way that ordinary Finns think about Russia and think about NATO. It was, I think, I've never seen anything happening, this big happening so quickly in politics. So basically people were supporting the NATO membership, like maybe under 30% of Finns were. And then after the war, it shot up like 60, 70, 80% in like a couple of months. So Sanna Marin has been, actually her party was against NATO membership. And Sanna Marin was like the key figure in changing the whole party's feeling about NATO.
What did she as an individual do to change that thinking?
It happened that in early 22, she said that not under my watch, when she was asked about NATO, applying NATO membership. And then it took, I can't remember, maybe a month or so. And then she said that she's pro-NATO. So something happened very, very quickly. And of course, we know that in her party, there is this older generation of politicians who have been very much against NATO membership. And she probably had the wisdom, if you say, like not listening to those old guys at that time. She really went her way in that.
Uwe, so much has been said and written about what Zelensky in Ukraine has done to, I suppose, refocus the mind of Western nations on the value of alliances and military spending. And I suppose Sanna Marin's position speaks to some of that. What has changed, particularly in this part of the world, since the invasion of Ukraine? And what does her position on this stuff tell us?
Yeah, look, I mean, first is that the Baltic countries and then the Nordic countries, you know, feel intensely vulnerable to Russia. And that's always been a problem. And so what one of the sea changes now is that they're going to try to make the Baltic Sea into a NATO lake, basically. So if you have Sweden and Finland joining, it's basically Russia very much encircled there. And the Zelensky effect, I mean, yeah, has rubbed off on Sanna Marin. I think she's sort of his opposite in the European Union camp, and they see and talk to each other all the time. But what she's also recognized in Zelensky, which hasn't always been picked up internationally, is that Zelensky is enormously pro-European. Sanna Marin says it's not only about making sure that Ukrainians prevail over the Russians in the military sense, but we need to give them something to look forward to. I mean, Ukrainians need to thrive within this future European Union. And what they're saying, what Zelensky, what Sanna Marin is saying, is Europe needs to equip itself. It is totally under-resourced when it comes to hard power. And so there's a big thing now about European strategic autonomy. What does that mean? It means that basically Europe needs to be able to resist invading armies without recourse to the Americans. Not that she's anti-American, but she says we need to help our US partners much more by doing more ourselves at home.
And Sala, the big test really will come for Sanna Marin on the 2nd of April. Finland goes to the polls, and she's actually not faced an election as leader or as prime minister. How likely do you think it is that she retains power, that she can pull together another coalition?
Well, if you look at the surveys now, it seems that she won't be prime minister after the elections. But of course, there is still some time before the election and things can happen, and her party is not that far behind. There's been also discussion of maybe Sanna Marin would be her party group's candidate for EU Commission's presidency. So let's see what happens.
If I can just add a footnote to that, what we often see with the women leaders, not often, but with fair regularity, is once they step out of the politics of their own country, they often do go on to international positions. Mary Robinson, the High Commissioner, Helen Clark, UNDP. It's interesting. So my hypothesis is if she does lose the election within Finland, that she will be tapped for some sort of international or regional position.
It's quite something to be a 37-year-old retired prime minister, isn't
it? So what did I do wrong, you know?
We'll leave it there. Really appreciate all of your time today. Laura Listwood, Sala and Uwe here in the studio. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Hamish.
Thanks. Yeah, it was really nice talking to you. Cheers.
Yeah, thank you.
Good show.
If you enjoyed the podcast, please tell your friends, leave us a review on your podcasting app, a few stars if you're feeling generous, and make sure you subscribe so you never miss an episode. The producer of this is Linda Lopresti. The series producer is Greg Muller, and the sound engineer is Beth Stewart. Salah, how do I pronounce your surname?
Yeah, I noticed that you skipped it, which I totally understand. If you want to pronounce it like Finnish do, it's Vuorikoski.
Okay. I'll just say thank you.
That's right.
Vuorikoski. Vuorikoski.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.